From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's show, we talk about replacing coal-burning power plants with less polluting natural gas-burning power plants.
It's true that it does have a lower rate of greenhouse gas emissions than coal, but it still does produce greenhouse gas emissions.
An expert says cutting costs with a private company providing health care for inmates might be the wrong choice.
The contractor is rewarded, actually, for cutting costs. And in healthcare, the easiest and most direct way to cut costs is just simply to deny care.
But the Department of Corrections official overseeing that contract says she's watching and penalizing the healthcare company when it does not meet requirements.
So we have assessed a little over $1 million.
And you can thank a Michigan U.S. Senator for keeping your money safe in a bank.
The FDIC is created. Turns out it's one of the most successful programs of the New Deal. Roosevelt later takes credit for it, but it was Arthur Vandenberg's baby.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's show, privatizing inmate health care.
Its track record here in Michigan has been one where there were problems early on, and those problems were corrected primarily by throwing more money at the system.
We'll talk about how the Michigan Department of Corrections enforces its contract with Corizon Health. That's coming up later this hour. But first, utility companies are shutting down some of their older, less efficient coal-burning power plants. To generate electricity to replace those old plants, utilities have to decide whether to go and build another coal-fired plant or go with natural gas or nuclear, renewable energy, or some combination. Recently, DTE Energy decided it would replace some older coal-burning plants primarily with a natural gas-burning plant with a little additional renewable energy. Six other natural gas plants are planned by utilities around the state. Environmentalists have criticized the decision and state regulators' approval of the DTE plant. They think the plant is an expense that ratepayers should not have to bear when renewable energy continues to decrease in cost. Here to talk about some of that is Sarah Mills. She's a senior project manager at the University of Michigan's Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We know that natural gas is cheaper now due to the extraction method of the horizontal hydraulic fracturing, or most people call it fracking. That's got its own set of environmental concerns. But natural gas has a lower rate of greenhouse gas emissions than coal. So why aren't environmentalists celebrating?
It's true that it does have a lower rate of greenhouse gas emissions than coal, but it still does produce greenhouse gas emissions. And it's not just from burning it, but it's also from the process of producing it. In that production, it actually leaks methane, which is a more potent
greenhouse gas, yeah, right?
Exactly. The other reason that environmentalists are concerned is that when you build a brand new natural gas plant, that plant has a life of 50 to 60 years. And so, especially if it's a big new plant, you're locking yourself into using that fossil fuel source for the next 50 to 60 years. I think most pragmatic environmentalists would say that we do need natural gas as kind of a bridge until we can get enough renewables built. But I think that the biggest reaction is to just the size of this plant and the fact that it's going to lock us into that, you know, 1,100 megawatts for the next 60 years.
The large utility companies stress that they have to have these fossil fuel plants to maintain the base load, that is the minimum level of demand for power with other sources used for additional power. How feasible is it for power companies to meet base load with renewable energy?
So meeting base load, I think, isn't the biggest concern. And this is one where natural gas and renewables actually work really well together. And so moving to a situation where you include both natural gas and renewables is helpful. Sure, natural gas can meet the base load. Generally speaking, we can also, you know, whenever the wind is blowing or solar panels are producing power, we're going to want to use that. It's the cheapest power. There's no fuel cost associated with that. Natural gas can fill in the gaps along the way. And so that's one of the benefits, is that it can quickly ramp up in times when we're not producing enough from renewables.
And that's one of the things they do now when there's peak demand. They have what they call peaker plants, which are basically jet engines that turn a turbine. They're a little expensive to use, but why couldn't we have a series of those that we only use on occasion when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine?
I think, quite honestly, it's just easier logistically to build a natural gas plant. If you want to retire 1,100 megawatts of coal, with a single natural gas plant, you can do that all on one site. If you want to get 1,100 megawatts of renewables, we're talking about large landscapes where we need to put a turbine. A single wind turbine is 2 to 3 megawatts. So you're going to need 500 of those to get that same power.
I want to talk about that a little later because some people are not thrilled about so many turbines going up. But I've been told that Michigan is falling behind in the shift to renewable energy. And I know Minnesota has really embraced wind energy. How does Michigan compare to some of the other Midwestern states?
Michigan does not certainly have the same renewables that Minnesota or even Illinois have. They have much stronger renewable portfolio standards there. They've really made a faster transition. And honestly, our level of coal-fired production is still, it's come down in recent years, but it's not as quickly as some of the neighboring states.
So what is the disadvantage to Michigan? I mean, if we're our electric rates are steady, we've got that base load taken care of, we're going to build these new gas-fired plants, we know we have stability there versus what could be the unknown. So what's the economic cost in the long run by relying so much on natural gas plants?
Part of the challenge is you don't know what's going to happen to the price of natural gas in the future. So right now, natural gas is cheap, but in order to keep that natural gas-fired power plant running for the next 50 years, you're going to have to buy fuel on a continual basis. And it's cheap now, but who knows what will happen in the future. So that's among the reasons that when you really look over the long term, renewables, they may be more expensive up front, but over the long haul, you know exactly what your fuel is going to cost, which is zero. And so that's one of the reasons that we're at a disadvantage. The other reason is that we may be able to meet the state's requirement for renewable energy. We may be able to keep the lights on, but we have a lot of companies and a lot of municipalities that have climate goals that want to see more renewable energy production. And so to meet customer demand, we need to put more renewables on the grid.
Some people have very positive reactions to wind energy. They view it as nearly magical windmills taking energy out of the air. Others, especially in areas where wind turbines are planned, have a much different reaction. They're worried about that big whooshing sound, which they say causes all kinds of problems. They're concerned about birds being killed, the marring of scenic vistas, especially if you're talking about offshore wind turbines. What are some of the other hurdles to more reliance on renewable energy?
Any power plant has its benefits and its drawbacks. Most people don't think that a natural gas-fired power plant is a beautiful creation, and it has certainly environmental impacts in the areas around it. One of the key challenges, though, for renewables is that their geographic footprint is just so much bigger. So, for example, let me give an example. The natural gas plant that DTE has proposed for East China Township in St. Clair County for 1,100 megawatts is about 100 acres that it takes up. DTE is also right now trying to get leases to build a wind farm in Branch County, which is by Coldwater in the south central side of the state. And they are looking to lease 40,000 acres of land. Now, to site 50 to 60 turbines, which would only be about 20% of the capacity of that natural gas plant on 100 acres. They're not using up that entire 40,000 acres. The wind turbine itself only takes up an acre or two. But they need this large expanse of land to have the wind turbines operate properly.
And let's be clear, they're not purchasing 40,000 acres. They're just leasing from a farmer and paying that farmer or whoever owns the land a fee each year.
Exactly. And so that's another place where renewable energy development is different than traditional coal fire or natural gas fired power plant. For the coal or natural gas plant, DTE is going to own that property. In a renewable plant, they often lease the land, which provides an added benefit for the members of that community because they're now getting an annual lease payment from DTE for leasing out that land.
We've seen solar being put up. In fact, some of the utilities are putting up some solar arrays. But the problem is, as you mentioned, they take up a lot of space. And one of my environmentalist friends suggested if everybody had a solar array on their rooftop, you wouldn't have to worry about it that much. How can that work? How can the utilities actually still make money if everybody has a solar array on their roof?
When you're talking about everybody's rooftop to have solar on it, you're losing some of the economies of scale that you get when you build a huge solar farm like you see outside of Lapeer.
Right. I was told it's something like $1.20 per square foot versus $3.50 per square foot, depending on whether it's a huge commercial operation or a local house operation.
Right. And again, it's the logistics of this. So making sure that the roof is structurally sound for this and that you're doing all of the interconnects. It's a lot easier if you're making utility scale projects. It's logistically easier and it's cheaper.
President Trump wants to bring back, as he calls it, beautiful, clean coal. You're involved in the National Surveys on Energy and Environment. What are American attitudes about fossil fuels like coal these days?
So most Americans are not in lockstep with the president's thinking on this. There is much more support for actually phasing out entirely coal-fired power plants than there is opposition to that. When you ask Americans, though, about clean coal, and that typically means carbon capture and sequestration, there is support for state governments, for example, to put money towards looking at carbon sequestration associated with clean coal technologies. We found, though, that that's not exactly what the president means by clean coal, that he's not, in fact, putting federal dollars towards carbon capture and sequestration. He thinks that there's some way that you can make the coal itself cleaner, which is not really what's meant by clean coal.
I'm wondering if there's been a trend toward embracing renewables and rejecting fossil fuels over time, or whether it's been staying the same.
So generally, the support for phasing out coal itself has been growing. This National Surveys on Energy and the Environment we've run for the last decade. And we have seen early on that there was less support for a phase out than we currently see. Support for renewables has also been growing, but there was high support to begin with for renewable energy. So there's just not much place to go if there's already strong support. And this is bipartisan support, too, for renewable energy. Even if you don't necessarily believe that the climate is changing, there's also support for renewables.
Sarah Mills is a senior project manager at the University of Michigan Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. Hey, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the Michigan Department of Corrections says it's got a tougher contract with its private provider for inmate health care. That's meant more penalties for the company.
So we have assessed a little over $1 million.
Plus a Grand Rapids distiller and its Beer City whiskey. That's in 20 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A state prisoner complained of chest pain and difficulty breathing, and according to a Free Press report, 37-year-old John Stein at the Cotton Correctional Facility at Jackson went to the prison healthcare unit. A short time later, he was sent back to his cell. There, he collapsed and died. A $50 million lawsuit has been filed against the Michigan Department of Corrections and a private company hired to handle inmate healthcare, Corizon Health. The Tennessee-based company has contracts for more than 500 prisons and jails across the nation. According to a company press release last year, Corizon Health has been the healthcare provider for the Michigan Department of Corrections since 1998. And its contract last year was expanded, more services to provide mental health and pharmacy now. Roland Zullo is an assistant research scientist at the Economic Growth Institute at the University of Michigan, and he studies privatization at places such as prisons. I found a lot of reports about lawsuits filed against Corizon Health across the nation. There was extensive coverage of the company by a lot of news media questioning its record and whether the company was properly monitored by officials. If Michigan's corrections system has been using Corizon for nearly two decades, what's known about its track record here?
Its track record here in Michigan has been one where there were problems early on, and those problems were corrected primarily by throwing more money at the system. What they have is a managed care model, so they're paid a fixed amount per prisoner per month to provide care, And there's some variation there. But by and large, for most of the clinical care that happens within the system, they're paid a fixed amount. And under that kind of payment system, the contractor is rewarded actually for cutting costs. And in healthcare, the easiest and most direct way to cut costs is just simply to deny care.
That kind of defeats the purpose of a healthcare provider, doesn't it?
Well, it does, especially now. There are ways to deal with this. If there are other individuals, other key decision points in the system controlled by other parties that determine whether or not an inmate receives care. And this was the case up until year 2000. So in year 2000, up until year 2000, the physicians and the physician's assistants were all public employees. And it was the physicians who could assess whether or not an inmate needed care and then refer them to specialty care. And specialty care are things that happen outside of the prison walls. So for example, a heart operation or, you know, something very serious, a cancer treatment. And what happened in around 2000 is that these physicians started to become employees of Corizon. So that check against the possibility that inmates would be denied care when they needed it was removed beginning in 2000.
In this particular case, the reports indicate there were two nurses involved in this Cotton Correctional Facility incident. One worked for the state, one worked for Corizon. Is a public employee and a private employee a typical arrangement in these healthcare centers in the prisons?
We have a mixed system right now. So many of the nurses are public. Many of the dentists are public. Some of the other staff are public. But most of the physicians, psychiatrists, and physician's assistants and nursing aides, I believe, are private. It's a mixed model, which can sometimes work, but usually it causes conflict between the parties.
Do we know how vigorously the Michigan Department of Corrections enforces the contract with Corizon to make sure that these inmates are getting the level of health care that they should be getting?
Well, this is one of the difficulties with health care, because to really monitor health care, you have to have someone external to the contractor who understands medicine, who can evaluate what a doctor has decided upon and then sometimes rule against what a doctor has decided upon. And this is why monitoring this kind of service is so expensive and difficult. So yes, there's a contract, and the contract lists all kinds of great detail on what the contractor is supposed to provide. But actually overseeing whether or not those decisions are being made is expensive and very hard to do.
Of course, the goal of privatizing is to save taxpayer money, because the private sector is supposed to be more efficient than having state staff do the job. And we have a lot of instances where we have private sector doing jobs or doing projects that used to be done by public employees all across state government. Do these work? Do we have enough track record now to know whether we're actually saving money in the long run?
Well, that's one of the great myths that's been debunked by recent literature. Early on, when people first began studying privatization, it did appear that there were savings to be had by using private contractors instead of public employees. But the most recent and best research on the topic suggests otherwise. Now, the difference, really, is that the early research didn't adjust for what we were actually getting for what we were paying for. When you think about any kind of outsourcing, it's not just simply cost, it's value. And value is what we pay, but also what we get in return for what we pay. And when you begin to adjust for the fact that you receive a different kind of service under a private contract model, then typically the public sector comes out ahead in providing public value.
Now, you suggested that the way the company can save money is to withhold care. Do we have any evidence of that?
What we have is, other than the lawsuits, which in this, the lawsuit you mentioned wasn't the first one.
No, so in fact, there's been a lot of them across the country. The CEO at Corizon says there's a huge number of lawsuits, but they're not specific to Corizon. They're specific to this industry.
Sure. I think prisons are areas of intense litigation that happens. And part of the reason for that is healthcare has to be provided constitutionally to the inmates that we have behind bars. We have to provide that. It's a cruel and unusual punishment not to provide health care to people who are in our jails and prisons. And so what happens is this difficult situation where inmates are entitled to care, but clearly the way to cut costs is to either deny or delay care. Now, it's not in the state's interest to do that. The state is best if it provides adequate care. Sometimes inmates will feign an illness in order to sort of break the routine of being inside of a jail. That happens. But by and large, the way any kind of health care situation should be assessed is by a professional based upon their best professional judgment. And the problem with privatization is it throws in an economic incentive into this equation. I think we can all relate to wanting to go to our doctors and having our doctor give us advice based upon what's best for us and not what's best for their bottom line. And that kind of corruption, which in the social sciences we call a moral hazard, happens once you begin to privatize. There's really no way around it. The way to cut costs is to either deny or delay care, and that has implications for the inmates, but also for society at large.
So if you had a chance to sit down with the governor, some of the legislative leaders, and the DOC head, what would you tell them?
Well, I would tell them that they should take the advice of others, not just me, but others who have recommended returning to a public system, hiring public staff to provide care, and pay them fairly, and create a public system that's well integrated. So essentially everyone is on the same team, and judge those professionals based upon the healthcare outcomes for the inmates. This is ultimately what we should be concerned about, and not about whether or not we're earning a certain amount of profit by our actions.
You understand that it's not popular among taxpayers to say, hey, we need to spend more money in the prisons. I mean, there's already an outcry about spending so much on the Department of Corrections.
Right. Only that I think that the system I'm outlining would potentially save tens of millions. There's no evidence that this contract is saving money, and we can see that in the contract itself. So, you know, for example, if in the contract it specifies what would happen if the system needed a dentist. So if we had to hire a dentist through Corizon, it would cost us $128.34 an hour, which comes up full-time at $267,000 a year. Well, if you go to the state website and you look up the dentist positions for the Department of Corrections, the top rate there is $58 an hour. That's what they pay, top rate for a dentist. That, if you add a roll-up for benefits, comes to about $181,000 a year. So the difference there, outsourcing, is roughly, for that one position, is between $80,000 and $90,000 a year.
How typical is that?
Well, it's typical for the positions at the higher-end scale. We pay a premium for privatizing for psychiatrists, physicians, nurses, dentists, and so forth. And those are the staff that we outsource, in addition to the management for the specialty services. So if the concern is about government expenditure, quite confident, although I preface this by saying that we would need to have a study on it because there are many moving parts, but I'm quite confident that the state could save tens of millions if it moved to a pure public system.
That is Roland Zullo. He's an assistant research scientist at the Economic Growth Institute at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Lester.
Let's turn now to the Michigan Department of Corrections. Marty K. Sherry oversees the Corizon contract. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So Corizon has faced penalties in the past because it wasn't meeting the level of service specified in the contract. And I was reading a prison legal news report from last year that said a past audit found Corizon was not keeping track of care for all the prisoners with chronic health conditions. The department didn't charge the majority of the prisoners the $5 copay it was supposed to, and your agency only completed 50% of the required audits of Corizon's performance, among other things. So where is the Department of Corrections and Corizon in correcting these shortcomings?
Well, with Director Washington, we have established a new contract monitoring unit. One of the things that I do as a contract manager is that I monitor the Corizon contract. We have, with the new contract that started in June 2016, we have 24 service level agreements. We have assessed all of them. We're current and up to date with those. We have staff now under my team. I have 4 contract monitors and a financial specialist that work in ensuring that the contract requirements are met.
Okay. Let's look at the big picture here for a second. Our expert argues that the state is kidding itself if it thinks it's saving money through privatization of medical services. He argues basically you get what you pay for, and when your way of making money is to reduce cost, the primary way to reduce cost of health care is to deny prisoners care or delay care. How do you ensure that's not happening?
Well, we have a chief medical officer on our side, and we have an assistant chief medical officer, and then we have a chief psychiatric officer. So with the contract, we have our monitoring team, but we also have a clinical monitoring team that is ensuring that the services provided to prisoners are not only timely but appropriate for their care and the conditions that they have.
Okay, if I heard you right, that's 3 people, and they're keeping track of all the medical staff at Corizon working in prisons?
No, those are our medical leadership. We also have the nurse managers. We have mental health leadership. We also have all of the nurses in the field. We have social workers. So we not only have my team, but we also have correctional facility staff monitoring and making sure that they're providing appropriate services. So our clinics are operated by our nurses and our nurse supervisors and nurse managers. So they're doing a kind of a checks and balances on that.
What's it cost to do that?
Ooh, that's not my area in terms of cost. In terms of our cost, I myself, a contract manager, I have a little over 100 contracts that I manage and I have my staff. So I wouldn't be able to speak on the budget for healthcare.
So you don't know how much it costs to monitor Corizon. How much does the state pay annually for Corizon providing healthcare?
So the contract for Corizon is $655 million. It's a 5-year contract with 3 option years.
And that happened, as I understand it, even though we got this extension of the contract, because it was the contractor before, that happened even though there were all these shortcomings in this audit. So what was the justification when the state decided, yep, we're going to stick with them?
Well, we went out for a request for a proposal, an RFP process. This is a little bit different than our previous contract. Our previous contract with Corizon was just for health care. In the new contract, we did an integrated care contract that included health care, mental health, and pharmacy. And through the RFP process, we had a technical score. Corizon scored one of the highest in the technical score and then a best value. And then my role and the department's role is making sure that we are monitoring and making sure that they provide appropriate care to prisoners.
There was an incident last year at the Cotton Correctional Facility. A 37-year-old inmate died shortly after being turned away when he sought medical help. What is the Department of Corrections doing to make sure something like that doesn't happen again?
Again, that's not really my area of expertise. We have a healthcare administrator that would probably be better to answer that question. I'm focused more on ensuring that the contract standards are monitored and don't specifically work directly with the care in the facilities.
So are you convinced that you said you went through this assessment earlier, you've completed it. Are you convinced the Corizon was the right way to go instead of another firm or going back to public employees?
I think overall, in my role as a contract manager, Corizon has been very responsive when we've identified areas for improvement within the contract. I think in terms of the request for proposal process, you know, we follow the standard DTMB policies and protocols, and they scored appropriately. They're the best value for the state, and we have now a process to make sure that they ensure timely care.
During this new contract with Corizon, have they been performing well enough to avoid penalties, financial penalties that they've had in the past?
No, they still have financial penalties. We have, since we implemented the new contract, we've actually added 24 service level agreements, and we monitor them more closely. So in the past, we have monitored them quarterly. We changed that under this contract to monthly. So the assessments are a little bit more frequent. What we have seen since the start of the contract is we are seeing that the credits are decreasing, and we hope to continue that pattern. But for now, we still are assessing them.
How much has it cost the company so far?
So we have assessed a little over $1 million in credits since the start of the contract.
Do you think the state is actually saving money?
In terms of saving money, that would be more of a question for our budget folks.
Okay, all right. Fair enough. That's Marty K. Sherry. She is with the Michigan Department of Corrections. She oversees the Corizon contract, among others. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
There is so much to talk about in this big and diverse state of ours that we cannot possibly know about at all. That's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. So if you have a question about Michigan, something you've always wondered about, send it along by going to the Am I Curious page at michiganradio.org. Still to come, we'll hear about a powerful but little-known U.S. senator from Grand Rapids.
He really viewed compromise not as something bad, but almost as an art form, as the way our democracy is supposed to work.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. When was the last time you heard about a politician who realized he needed to change to help his country, that former ways had to be put aside to foster bipartisan cooperation for the good of the country? Well, you're about to hear about one, a U.S. Senator from Michigan, Arthur Vandenberg. There's a new biography about him. Its author is Hank Meyer. I spoke to Meyer in January, and here's that conversation. Your subtitle of this book, The Man in the Middle of the American Century, in what way was Arthur Vandenberg in the middle of the American century?
Well, Lester, he really symbolized in many ways the changing role of the United States in the world. He had gone from being an isolationist before World War II and coming out of World War I saying, we've got to stay out of other people's wars and let's not put our boys in harm's way in Europe. Let's be neutral when these new wars were going to break out. And this is at a time when Hitler was coming to power and Mussolini and the Japanese are invading Manchuria. And then after the war, he came to recognize that America was the global undisputed superpower, that we had responsibilities to lead in the world, and that it was both in our interests and in the interest of world peace for the U.S. to take a leading role in forming the United Nations and in helping rebuild Europe through the Marshall Plan, things like that.
I want to talk further about how he got there, but let's start first with where he grew up. Grand Rapids, early childhood, pretty comfortable, but then the economy went bust and the family business went with it. What effect did that have on a young Vandenberg?
This is a young man who at the age of 9 started helping support his family. He started a little delivery service between a shoe factory in downtown Grand Rapids and the railroad depot. And his father had a harness business, as you say, had been fairly prosperous. And then in the panic of 1893, an early depression, lost most of that business. So Arthur felt a real sense of responsibility, and he was a real go-getter. And so he was working all through school. He spent a year at the University of Michigan, then got a job as a reporter at the Grand Rapids Herald.
Right, and he quickly found himself leading the Grand Rapids Herald fairly shortly after he was there. I mean, a few years I'm speaking about. It was a Republican newspaper. What was it about him that led to such success so early in life?
This was a time when newspapers were, I don't want to say the only source of news, but certainly the most important. And his was the Republican newspaper. Most papers were also partisan at the time in this rapidly growing city. And he was a young orator. He was a pretty good writer. And he became editor at 22. And he's writing editorials every day for the newspaper, sending them off to Republican leaders in Washington. And so 10 years later, at the end of World War I, he's influencing the League of Nations debate by supplying arguments to Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the Republican chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, who's fighting with Woodrow Wilson over the covenant of the League of Nations.
He was involved fairly deeply in Michigan politics, too, and finally was appointed to fill a vacancy in the U.S. Senate. How did he first make his mark in the Senate?
He first came there in a way characteristic of his entire career, trying to build bridges. He came in just as Herbert Hoover became president in 1928, and Hoover was a brilliant engineer and administrator, but with no political experience. And the Republican Party, split as it often is, was split in those days between what was called the Old Guard, which was sort of the Eastern establishment, but very conservative, and the progressives, who tended to be Western politicians. And he came in trying to get them to work together with the president. They were both suspicious of Hoover. And so he went in trying to build bridges, but also first established his name with the early days of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. So the Depression comes in 1929, and in 1932 and 33, the economy is bottoming out. And in Detroit, in the first major city in the country, there was a banking crisis. The holding companies that owned the banks in Detroit were on the verge of collapse. And as a senator from Michigan, Vandenberg was trying to figure out how to rescue them and how to protect Michigan citizens and their savings deposits. And so he's negotiating the idea of deposit insurance, what became the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC. He brings that idea to Herbert Hoover and his Secretary of the Treasury. They don't want to have anything to do with it. This looks like a government bailout of the banks. And Vandenberg is saying, you know what, the only way we can restore confidence in our economy and in our banking system is if small depositors know that they can get their money out once they put it in. So then Franklin Roosevelt comes in. He goes to Roosevelt. He's been governor of New York, certainly no friend of Wall Street, but buying into the argument that strong banks shouldn't be trying to prop up weak ones. And so he doesn't want to have anything to do with deposit insurance. But Vandenberg lines up the votes in the Senate in a bipartisan way, and the FDIC is created. Turns out it's one of the most successful programs of the Depression, of the New Deal. Roosevelt later takes credit for it, but it was Arthur Vandenberg's baby.
Like any good writer, you found small stories that told big things about Vandenberg. There was a moment in the book that really struck me. It's 1932, depths of the Depression. A Michigan fruit grower named Adolph Belter came to Senator Vandenberg. His house had burned, and he brought in some charred rolls of money that he'd had stashed in a mason jar, presumably because no one trusted the banks at the time. The money was ruined. But Mr. Belter was hoping that Senator Vandenberg could somehow do something, anything for him. Tell us what happened.
Well, constituent service is an important part of a politician's job. And so he marched over to the Treasury Department with Adolph Belter, and they went to the people who work with the mint, and they have scientists who try to determine the origins of currency. And they were able to look at the charred remains of the farmers' dollar bills and figure out the denominations and were able to issue currency to help him. But you're right, that symbolized a time when people no longer trusted the banks. And so they're putting their money in mason jars, they're putting their money under the mattress, and there was no way the economy was going to get started again if that's what we felt we had to do to protect ourselves.
So as you mentioned, he didn't really like President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. He was an isolationist and against getting into another war in Europe. But this staunch Republican learned to work with Democrats to get things done during the biggest trial this nation has faced in its years. What's the lesson there for today's politicians?
He really viewed compromise not as something bad, but almost as an art form, as the way our democracy is supposed to work. Now, he learned that lesson painfully because Roosevelt was swept into office to fight the Depression, and the Republicans were tarred by the disaster of the Depression. And so by 1934, after that midterm election, there were only 17 Republicans in the Senate. So if you wanted to get anything done, whether it was deposit insurance or stopping some extravagant spending plan of the president's, and he was a good conservative, you had to work across the aisle. So he honed those skills out of necessity. But then when the big stuff came after World War II, and these were momentous decisions, do we join a United Nations? Do we commit ourselves to this massive aid program to rebuild the European democracies? Do we enter into an entangling alliance, which Vandenberg had always been loath to do because he was a follower of Alexander Hamilton, who advised George Washington not to do that, and then which became NATO? Those are things that shouldn't be done by one party. Those are committing the American people to major undertakings and sometimes sacrifices, and we've all got to do it together. And so he recognized that, and that really motivated him to reach across the aisle.
Vandenberg was well known in his time. He was mentioned in the same breath with names like Churchill and Roosevelt. He was well thought of. He was begrudgingly respected by his opponents, mentioned as a possible president in the future. Edward R. Murrow called him the central pivot of the entire era. How is it we don't know him better?
It's funny how some people can slip through the cracks of history. He was an editorial writer himself, had written short stories, had always wanted to write his own memoirs, but died of cancer while still in office and was unable to do that. He had two other would-be biographers. One was a reporter for the rival Grand Rapids Press who kept voluminous scrapbooks, was a Vandenberg contemporary, but didn't live to write anything. And then another biographer who had turned his dissertation at University of Michigan back in 1970 into the first of two volumes of Vandenberg died before he could write the second volume. And the second volume really covers the most important years of Vandenberg's life. And so if you don't live to write the history and somebody else writes it from their point of view, it's awfully easy to be forgotten. And we tend to look at history in our modern age through presidential eras. And so if you're not president, unless you're some kind of notorious character, you tend to slip between the cracks of political history.
You mentioned FDIC, you mentioned NATO. What do you think his lasting legacies, his accomplishments that affect our lives are today?
Unquestionably, he was indispensable in helping with the Marshall Plan. When Europe was devastated after the war and the most powerful military force in Europe was the Red Army, who now had swallowed up Poland and some of the other Eastern European countries, and Britain, France, the Netherlands, all these countries, their economies are crushed. President Truman had the good sense, knowing that we had to help them, to call his proposal the Marshall Plan, because General Marshall was revered and nonpartisan. Marshall said it could have been called the Vandenberg Plan, because Vandenberg really put it through. And that resurrected Western civilization to some extent, or was awfully important. And then on the heels of that came the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, that said, you know, we democracies have shared values, and we really need to be mutually assisting one another to protect ourselves, in this case, from the communist threat that had replaced the Nazi threat after World War II. Those are his big pieces of legislation. But more than that, I think, is the spirit of compromise that said, I am going to find a middle ground because that's where the interests of the American people ultimately lie. And he became a symbol so that now every time there is a foreign policy crisis of some kind and you have one party in the White House and the other party in Congress, somebody said, well, where is there a Vandenberg now? And so I think that symbol of how we want our government to work may be his most lasting legacy.
You've got a day job. Your time is in demand. You spent all this time writing this biography of Arthur Vandenberg. What was it that caught your attention that you wanted to commit yourself to that?
He was a local guy, and I had been in the newspaper business as well. I'd gone to the University of Michigan as well. I graduated from public high school in Grand Rapids as well, so I always felt a little commonality there and have always loved foreign policy and international politics. But beyond that, I got to have this sense of mission, that this was an important story that hadn't been told. And you could walk down the street 20 years ago in Grand Rapids and say, who was Arthur Vandenberg? And literally people would say, well, was he related to the jewelry store? Because there used to be a jewelry store of that name. No, he wasn't. But he did some other things. There was a young man named Gerald Ford who got his start in politics with the endorsement of Arthur Vandenberg. And so he was this really major figure who was forgotten to a large degree in his own hometown and in his own home state, even as he was a major figure at a crucial time in our history on the world stage.
Hank Meyer is the author of the book Arthur Vandenberg, The Man in the Middle of the American Century. Mr. Meyer's day job is executive chairman of Meyer Incorporated. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
It's a pleasure, Lester. Thank you.
It's Friday, time for a cocktail. Here's one we liked from our archives.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings.
We're here at Long Road Distillers in Grand Rapids, and you can't talk about Grand Rapids without talking about beer, and today we're going to talk about both beer and spirits because Long Road has come up with a Beer City whiskey line.
Kyle Van Streen's here. What does that mean, a Beer City whiskey line? What's involved in that?
So this is our series of whiskeys that we've partnered with local breweries to make. We felt like there was an opportunity for us to partner with those breweries that have made us so famous and create a line of spirits that was unique and really highlighted some of their more popular beers. The first in the release is from the Mitten Brewing Company, who happens to be our next door neighbors here on Leonard Street on the west side of downtown. We've taken their Country Strong IPA, and we've turned that into a malt whiskey.
Wait, you're turning beer into whiskey. Tell me how that works.
The mash of the beer, which is very closely related to our mash. It's just grain that's been cooked in some, depending on which hops or other additives are put into a beer, there's some additional flavorings that happen. But it's an unfinished beer, so it hasn't been fully filtered out, it hasn't been carbonated, things like that. Then we transfer it over into the still, distill it up to the appropriate proof, and then we've aged these whiskeys, these beer whiskeys, for between a year and a half and 2 years.
So I hear that the way this got started was actually a happy accident with your neighbors.
Yeah, at the Mitten Brewing Company, they've recently transitioned from a 3-barrel system up to a 20-barrel system, and in the process of doing that, they did lots and lots of test batches. Now, every brewer knows that you're going to have batches that go bad with infections, and the yeast just isn't happy, and so you have off flavors. And so the Mitten was very stringent about not putting out a product that they weren't completely satisfied, especially with their Country Strong IPA, which is one of their standbys. Rather than throw it down the drain, we said, hey, let's try it. We'll distill it. We'll see how it tastes, and we can go from there. And out of that, we discovered that it was pretty delightful, especially out of a barrel. And so we had them brew us some fresh batches, put that through the still, put it into barrel, and now we've recently released this first in the series of four.
All right, we should take a taste of that.
So I love an IPA beer, so I'm really intrigued to see how those hop flavors translate into a whiskey.
So we've got one here.
Well, it smells like whiskey, but it also has that little bit of a hoppy aroma going on. Wow. So much of that hops on the finish, which I don't expect in a whiskey at all, but I love it.
Second, I want to get to the second whiskey, though. You've got another one.
So in addition to our neighbors at the Mitten, we've also partnered with Perrin Brewing Company and Harmony Hall and Harmony Brewing Company and Grayline Brewing Company. All of them happen to be west of the river, which is fun for us, being good Westsiders and partnering with the four breweries on this side of town. But the next in this release, this lineup of releases, is the Perrin Black, which is a very popular beer from them, one of my favorites that they've produced, and turned into a malt whiskey. This is super mellow. It has a really nice malt roast characteristic. I think it's just a really delightful sipper.
Let's try that. Oh, that's so smooth. That is so smooth. I can't believe that.
What I love, again, I can taste that dark roast malt from a beer that I like in beer and that translates to the whiskey so well. And I also love the fact that it's completely different than the Mitten Country Strong, in the same way those two beers would be completely different.
And that's at Long Road Distillers in Grand Rapids. Thanks very much for telling us about this beer to whiskey. It's great.
Cheers.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.